I showed how the notion of freeness arises in the context of Riemann algebras of free group, and that was the motivating context for Vaiculescu to define this notion. And in the first lecture you have seen that the same kind of freeness relation also arises in the context of random matrices. And yeah, so today I want to talk somehow about a better understanding of this notion in combinatorial terms. But let me first recall our setting and this notion of freeness. So I mean, we are in the setting of a non-commutative probability space, A phi. So this just means A is a unital algebra, phi is a unital linear space. And I mean, whether we have von Neumann algebras or sister algebras, might be some additional structure which is important in special situations, but for the notion of freeness, it's not really needed. And freeness is something about sub-algebras of the given algebra. So let's say A1 up to AS, they are free. If the following happens, namely phi of special elements, A1 up to AN, is zero, namely whenever we have the following, that A's are coming from some of the subalgebras, so let's say AJ is from AIJ, then neighboring factors should come from different subalgebras, so A1 should be different from I2, I2 should be different from I3, and so on. And let's say IN minus 1 should be different from IN. Of course, it's only about neighbors, so I1 and I3 might be the same. It just means that neighbors should be different. And then each of the A's should be centered, so phi of AJ should be equal to 0 for all J. Okay, and last time we have seen that in principle this definition allows to calculate all mixed moments in elements from the subalgebras in terms of the moment of the element itself. But we also have seen that you have to do this in a recursive way by essentially centering elements and then possibly multiplying neighboring elements from the same algebra. And I mean, it's not easy to follow the structure of this procedure. So it's not, I mean, in principle we know there are formulas for all mixed moments, but at the moment we don't really understand the structure of this formula. Okay, and today I want to talk a bit more about this structure. So I want to show you that there's a nice combinatorial object in the background, and essentially that will be the notion of free cumulants, which allows us to understand this better. And in lecture one, I mean, we already have seen the notion of classical cumulants, which play a role in classical probability theory, and they are somehow related with partitions of sets, and it will turn out that in free probability theory we have free cumulants. I mean, we are going to define free cumulants, but they will be related to special partitions, namely non-crossing ones. And they have the same relation to non-crossing partitions as the classical cumulants have to all partitions. And in order to motivate the occurrence of these non-crossing objects in free probability theory, I want to start with proving the free central limit theorem, because there it shows up very canonically. And I mean, essentially, in the first lecture, we have seen somehow the occurrence of the free cumulants in a special way, namely by getting the limiting moments of Gaussian random matrices. Okay, but today I want to do this in the context of the free central limit theorem. So the lecture today will be essentially about the free central limit theorem and free cumulants. Okay, and we start with the central limit theorem, and actually we can do the classical and the free central limit theorem on the same footing, just to really see that things are really very parallel. So we do the classical and the free central limit theorem. Okay, so what is the central limit theorem about? So now, algebraic formulation. Let's say we have a non-commutative probability space, and then we have infinitely many elements there, a sequence of elements, let's say A1, A2, and so on, our algebra, and we assume just to make things easier, that they all have the same distribution. Well, so all their moments are the same, they don't depend on the index. So AI have the same distribution. So our AI are identically distributed. It's not necessary for the central limit theorem, but it makes things easier. And it shows still the main ideas. Okay, so this means that the moment, the nth moment of our random variable doesn't depend on the index. Huh? So for I and j, the nth moment of ai and aj is the same for all I and j. Okay, I mean the distribution of our random variables is just a collection of the moments. Huh? So we are just saying that this collection doesn't depend on the index. Then we would like our elements to be centered. So phi of ai is equal to 0. And it's the same for all i's. Okay, and then of course we need the crucial assumption about the relation between the AIs, and at the moment we just leave it open whether they should be independent or free. I mean they should be either this or this. Huh? Okay, so I mean a lot of the arguments we are doing don't really depend on which we choose. So of course at some point we have to specify, but at the moment we assume they are either independent, then we are looking on the classical central limit theorem, or they are free. Then we are looking on the free central limit theorem. Okay, and of course independence in this algebraic context means of course that we have classical random variables, which means the A's are functions, so they commute, and expectations of product factorize. Good. Okay, and now in the central limit theorem, I'm interested in a sum of my random variables, normalizing them in the right way, which is by square root of k, if I'm summing up k of those elements, and then I want to know, can I say anything meaningful about the limit if k goes to infinity. So a central limit theorem is about the limit k goes to infinity of sk. Also, we would like to know, does sk converge in some suitable sense to some limit object. Okay, and of course this means we first have to define what we mean with convergence, and in our setting where distribution is just a collection of the moments, I mean the only possibility which we have is to ask that all moments converge to something in a limit. Okay, and this should be the moment of the limit object. So this is our, yeah, so this is our definition of convergence, which we're going to call convergence in distribution. But which really means convergence of moments. Okay. And I mean, in many instances, this is really more or less the same as weak convergence in the classical context, if the limit distribution is determined by the moments. So it might look a bit weaker, but I mean, for the most cases, it's really the rephrasing of the weak convergence in our context. Okay, so let us make this definition. So assume we have for each k a probability space, and we have a limiting probability space. So k is here a natural number. This should be non-commutative probability spaces. Then we assume that we have elements from each of them. So let me call them bk. So those are the sk which I'm considering there. So I assume that I have bk in the aks, in the ak for each k in n. And I have a limit element, b in a, and I want to say that those bk converge to b. So as in the classical case of weak convergence, I mean I don't need a big probability space in which all my elements live. They can all live in different spaces. The only thing I'm going to compare is their distribution, which means their moments. For this I don't need that they live in the same space. So I mean here, I mean in this setting of course everything will live in this big A. Okay. But in general, I mean they could all live in different ones. So we say that bk converges in distribution to b, and we denote this by bk goes to b, and maybe it's good to put distribution here, if the distributions converge, which means that just every moment of the bk to the power n, the nth moment, converges, if k goes to infinity, to the corresponding moment of the b. So it goes to phi of b to the n. And this should be true for all n in n. Okay, so it's a convergence of the moment. So this means if we want to understand the limit of this normalized partial sum, if k goes to infinity, we should try to understand the moments of this object and see whether we can identify the limit of those moments. Okay, so this means in order to understand this limit theorem, we should look on the moments of this, and maybe for the moment we don't care about the square root of k, but just look on the sum. So we should try to understand what is the sum a1 up to ak to the power n. Can we say something about this if k goes to infinity? Of course, then we should take into account this normalization. And of course, if we just multiply this out, this is a quite big sum of phi of a r1 up to a rn. The limit is here. Okay, just running over all possibilities from 1 up to k. So we have to sum over all r1 rn between 1 and k. And of course, the problem is, in this formulation, I mean, there's nothing to say about k goes to infinity, because, I mean, then the number of terms will just increase. Okay. So the only hope which we have is that somehow, maybe, we can collect those terms into a number of classes which doesn't depend on k. And the point is that this is true, and this depends on the fact that many of the terms, the contributions which we get here for various indices, is actually the same. So namely, the main point is that phi of a r1 rn of such an index tuple appearing here can be and will be the same as phi for another index tuple if we have some conditions on the indices, namely whenever the indices are the same at the same positions. So this means if the index at position I is the same as the index at position j, then the same should happen on this side. Okay, and I will make this clear why this is the case. Okay, but that's actually the condition which we have. So why is this, or what do I mean with this? Yeah, so namely, let us look on A1, A2, A1, A1, A2, A3, something which might appear in this sum. And then, of course, we know that our variables are free or independent, and at the moment we are just using the fact that this means that we have a rule for calculating mixed moments in terms of the separate moments. Okay, but this means, of course, this rule doesn't really depend on what indices we have here. It's just the main point is just that the indices at this position, and this position are the same. So we have here the same indices. Then we have another index at those positions, and we have here a third one. So actually, this rule doesn't care about what index we have here. It doesn't care about the distribution which we have for this element. But the distribution of all the AIs is the same. So whether we have here A1 or A7 doesn't really matter. So this is actually the same, for example, as if we replace A1 by A7, maybe A2 by A5, and the other one by A8, because then we have the same pattern. We have here, here, and here, the same index. Here we have another index at those positions, and here a third one. Okay, and because we have independence of freeness, we have a rule which reduces this mixed moment to the distribution of the elements which are sitting at those positions. Okay, but A1 has the same distribution as A7, A2 has the same distribution as A5, and A3 has the same distribution as A8. So this means this rule produces the same answer for those moments. Okay, and so actually, the phi of such a tuple of A's doesn't really depend on the actual value of the indices, but it only cares about whether they are the same and whether they are different. So actually, it only depends somehow on this pattern here. Okay, and of course this pattern here really is a decomposition, it's a partition of the index set. I mean, it's just a partition of the positions 1 up to 6, in this case. So it's a 6th moment. Also, we have the position 1 up to 6, and this partition just tells us where we have the same index and where we have different indices. Okay, so I mean, this thing here, this is a, what we call a partition, usually are denoted by pi, and this is a partition of n, 1 up to n, n is 6 in this case, so of 1 up to n. Okay, and because this guy here only depends on this partition, I mean we can, again, going to denote by kappa of pi. So it's just a function of pi, of this pattern here. Okay, good. But then this means that, of course, in this above sum, we have many terms which give the same contribution, namely all those which correspond to the same pi. And then we can collect the terms which we have there into classes which correspond to the same pi. Okay, maybe, to write this down, maybe it's good to have a notation for the partition. So let me denote them by P of n. So these are the partitions of the set 1 up to n, which you also, denote like this, So, n in the square bracket is the same as the set 1 up to n. So what we have, what we see from this is that phi of a1 plus up to ak to the power n, actually, we can collect terms into classes corresponding to partitions of n, and then, of course, we get the contribution kappa pi for each element from this class, and then we just have to multiply with the number of indices which correspond to this class. Let me denote this by n of pi, and this, of course, depends on k. So this here is the number of n tuples corresponding to pi. And, of course, the tuples can take all values between 1 and k. Okay, now we really have achieved the crucial advantage, because this sum here is over partitions of n, and it doesn't depend on k. So this is really a sum which doesn't increase with k. Now we want to say to send k to infinity, and of course in above sum, if k goes to infinity, I mean we're getting more and more terms each term. Yeah. Okay, but here this is a final sum, a sum which doesn't depend on k, and the only dependence on k is here. Okay, but I mean this is very easy to see how this depends on k. So namely, what is n pi k? So it's the number of tuples of n tuples which should correspond to a given partition. Yeah, but I mean if we are given let's say one partition, the partition tells us that we should have one index, let's say at this position. I mean for this we have k possibilities. Okay, so we put this index here and here. Then for the next block, I mean, those guys we are calling the block of the partition, we should have a different index. It should be different from the first one, so we have k minus 1 possibilities, which we can put there, and so on. Okay, so for each block of our partition, we have more or less k possibilities. Okay, it should be different from the previous one, so it's k times k minus 1 times k minus 2, and so on. One number, one factor for each block. So this here is k times k minus 1 times k minus 2 up to k minus pi plus 1. Okay, so with this absolute value of pi, I mean the number of blocks in pi. Okay, so the blocks are the sets which tell me that I should have the same number at those positions. Okay, and of course if k goes to infinity, this behaves like k to the number of blocks. Okay, if k is very large, I can forget about the condition that the number should be different. Okay, so this goes as k to the number of blocks. Okay, maybe let us put it down here. Pi is the absolute value of pi is the number of blocks of pi. Good. Okay. Yeah. So this means that essentially we understand quite well the behavior of k goes to infinity. And we get a contribution for each pi, a contribution which we still have to understand. I mean, that's at the moment we just denoted formally by kappa of pi. Of course, we have to understand this better. But how this contribution goes in k, it goes essentially like k to the number of blocks in pi. Okay, so it will go somehow to infinity. And of course, we have to compensate this growth by dividing by an appropriate power in k. Okay, and I mean that we are dividing by the square root of k shows us that we expect that the leading contribution here will be of the order k to the n over 2, which of course might look like a problem at first, because of course we have pi's which have more blocks. So they shouldn't make a contribution, otherwise we will have a problem. Otherwise we would have chosen the wrong thing here. Okay, but actually it's quite easy to see that those don't contribute. So namely those are exactly the, yeah, this would be partitions which have singletons, which means I have blocks which consist only of one element. And it is easy to see that those are not contributing. So namely let us consider such a pi. So consider a pi with a singleton. So with this I mean that it has at least one block which consists only of one element. So this means pi, let me write it as V1, VS. So those are the blocks. Okay, but now singleton mean there is at least some block, Vm, which only consists of one element, let's say R. Okay, but what is the contribution of such a guy in our sum? So kappa of pi. So that was kappa of pi. So it's phi of a product of A's, where the indices at the A's correspond to this pattern of pi. Okay, so this means I have here phi. I have phi. I have here the indices up to the position m minus 1, and somehow the one at position m is special, this corresponds to the singleton, so there I have the index ar. So that's what this is saying, ar m plus 1 up to am. But the fact that this is a singleton means that this ar doesn't appear anywhere else, because this pi really tells me where I have the same indices and where I have different ones. If this is a singleton, this just means that this ar doesn't show up at the other positions. The indices here are different. Okay, it's twice. That's too much. So, okay. Yeah, good. Okay, but then, I mean, what we have here is actually we have here a product of things and here a product of things, and we know that the A's are all independent or free, so this means that this, the AR which appears here is free or independent from all the other things. Okay, so this variable here, let me write it down. So this variable is different from all others, and so maybe let me denote this product here by A and this by B. So what I really have here is phi of A times AR times B, where the AR is free from A and B, or independent, depend on what the assumption I have made. Okay, so A comma B is independent or free from AR. Okay, and now of course I have to use that as somehow I know how to calculate things like this, but this is a very simple mixed moment. And this is something which actually I showed you how to calculate in the case of free variables, and in the case of independent variables, it's the same. And if things are independent, then it commutes, then it's phi of A times B times AR. AR is free from A times B, so it factorizes. And the same formula was true in the free case. So this is, in both cases, this is phi of A times B times phi of AR. Okay. So you see, I mean, up to now, I only have used that freeness independence are rules for calculating mixed moments, and I'm using only very little about how this really looks like. I mean, these very simple things. These are very easy part of the rules. Okay, but now our variables are centered. That's a crucial point here. Then I need them centered. So this means phi applied on any of them is the zero. So this means this whole guy here is equal to zero. So this means singletons really give the contribution zero. Okay, so this means in our sum here, singletons, if pi has a singleton, it doesn't contribute. Or to put it the other way, if it has to contribute, each block must contain at least two elements. Okay, but this means how many blocks can I have at most? I mean, I have n numbers, I want to distribute it into classes, each class contains at least two elements, this means I can have at most n over 2 classes. And now you see how I get n over 2, which is somehow the right leading term, which has to be compensated by the square root of k. Good. Okay, so this tells me that the pi, which contribute to our sum, maybe, let me denote this here by star, contributing in star, have the number of blocks less than n over 2. Okay, but now I'm dividing my sum exactly by the order which corresponds to n over 2, namely by the square root of k, taking the nth moment, so it's k to the n over 2. So this means, if I divide it by this, I'm exactly chilling in the limit everything which is really strictly less than n over 2. And what has the order n over 2 survives. Okay, but when do I have blocks which have exactly the order n over 2? This of course means that each class must contain exactly two elements. So if I'm dividing an element into classes, each class contains at least two elements, then can I have n over 2 classes? It's only if it has exactly two elements. Good. Okay, so I have that k to the number of pi divided by k over n over 2. This converges either to 1 or 0. If pi has n over 2 classes, and to 0 if it has less. Okay, good. Yeah, but that it has exactly n over 2, this is the same as saying, under the assumption that no singletons are not allowed, this is the same that each block has exactly two elements. Okay, and I mean such a thing you also go to call a pairing. Huh? It's special partitions which pair just elements. So each block has two elements, one element is paired to another one, so we say pi is a pairing. Okay, and I denote this by p of n is a subscript p, pi 2 of n. So this means the pi's which are pairings. Yeah, but this tells me that I exactly get the limit in my central limit theorem. So namely, I can, the conclusion of all this is that the limit of k going to infinity phi of my sum, of my nth element of the sum, so a1 up to ak, divided by the square root of k to the power n. Yeah. So I'm getting this sum over pi. Okay, but now we have convinced ourselves that the limit k going to infinity, only the pairings survive. Yeah, because the other ones have not enough blocks. Or they have singletons, and then they are also cancelled. Okay, and they survive with which contribution, of course, kappa pi, and I mean this, in this case, just goes to 1. So they just have the contribution kappa pi. Good. Okay, so I mean we have arrived at a formula which essentially tells us in the limit we have to look on pairings, and of course each pairing contributes something, which we still have to understand. Of course, I mean, this, at the moment this depends on pi, so we have to check what this really is. But first of all, I mean, we see, for example, that if we have an odd power, then clearly the moment is zero, because I mean there is no pairing of an odd number of elements. So I mean what we can see directly without thinking anymore is that there are no pairings of an odd number of elements, so this means the odd limit elements, limit moments, in our central limit theorem are zero. So we get in any case a symmetric distribution. Good. But of course now to say something more, we have to find out what this kappa pi is for the various pi's. And that's now the point where I have to differentiate between the classical and the free situation. I mean, it cannot be the same everywhere. I mean, up to now it was exactly the same in the classical and the free case. Because I have used only very little structure about freeness or independence. I have only used structure which is the same for both of them. Good. But now I have to look more closely into the rule for calculating mixed moments, and so now I should distinguish two cases to say what is kappa pi. So let us first look on the classical central limit theorem. So let us now assume that the A's are actually independent. So the classical central limit theorem, I assume that A1, A2, and so on, are independent, and what is then kappa pi? Well, it's very simple in this case. So namely, what was kappa pi? So kappa pi was phi of a product of my A's, where the pi tells me whether the indices are the same and whether they are different. So it's a product of AR1 up to ARN, where the pattern of these indices here is given by pi. Okay, but pi is a pairing, so this means every index appears twice. Of course, at which positions depends on pi. But in a classical situation, I mean, everything commutes, so we just can commute those things, that first we have the first two indices, then the next one, and so on, and then, I mean, because they are independent, it just factorizes. So it just factorizes, independent of pi, into the product of second moments. And how many second moments do I get? As many as I have blocks, or n over 2. Okay, so if I denote the second moment by sigma squared of my variables, I just get sigma to the 2n. Okay, and this is true for any pi. So in this case, actually, each pairing has the same contribution, namely sigma to the 2n, where sigma squared is the second moment, or is the variant. Sorry? I mean, if I denote this by sigma squared, then it's... Okay. Yeah, sigma to the n. Okay, good. Yeah, I have n over 2 factors. Each factor gives sigma squared, so it's sigma to the n. Good. Okay, so I can summarize this, that if the limit k going to infinity of phi a1 up to ak divided by square root of k to the power n is what? It's sigma to the n. Okay, so each, where's my formula? Yeah. So each here gives the same contribution, namely sigma to the n, and then I'm just remaining with counting how many elements in pi 2 I have. So what I get is sigma to the n times the number of elements in p2 of n. Okay, but those numbers are very easy to count, so namely that's a problem, so I have n points, and I want, and should of course be even, I want to pair them, how many possibilities do I have? So I mean, I take the first point, for this I have n minus 1 possibilities. Okay, then I take the next 3 points in this direction, okay, 2 points are already gone, so this has n minus 3 possibilities. So I multiply it with n minus 3. Then the next one has n minus 5, so I just get this product. Okay. So this is sigma n times n minus 1, n minus 3, up to 5 times 3 times 1. Okay. And so what we have got here, of course we know what it should be. I mean, we know in the classical context we converge to Gaussian variable, to normal distribution. So what we have got here should actually be the moments of a Gauss variable. And I mean, that's the case. I mean, this was also addressed in the first lecture. But I mean, this is somehow how you see that, how those numbers, I mean, you can just calculate the moments of a Gaussian variable if it's normalized with variance 1. I mean, you get integer numbers. Which, if you just take the formula of the Gaussian, it's not so clear why should you get integer numbers. But I mean, the central limit theorem tells you somehow a reason, because those numbers are actually counting some things. So they are counting the number of pairings of n elements. Okay, so, yeah, I mean, good. So this is easy to see. So we see from this that in the classical central limit theorem, we converge to the moment of the Gaussian. Okay, and I mean, you might wonder, okay, usually I say in a classical context that I have weak convergence to the Gaussian one, but I mean, this is actually the same, because the normal distribution is determined by its moments. If I know that the moments converge to the moments of a Gaussian, this really means that I have convergence, that I have weak convergence. So this is more or less, at least in a setting where I have moments of all my random variables, this is really a proof of the classical central limit theorem. Good. Okay, but I mean, so we are more interested in the free central limit theorem. So now we should switch to the free side. And then, of course, I mean, there will be a difference. Then, of course, I mean, we should get another limit. So it's not true that all kappa pi should give the same contribution. So let us look on this one, the free central limit theorem. So now we assume that the A's are free, not independent, but free. Okay, and then it turns out that not all pi's give the same contribution, but actually they will distinguish two classes of pi. And I mean, let us look, for example, on the situation of the fourth moment. So I mean, for the fourth moment we have three pairings. So it's this pairing. And it's this one, so we pair 1 with 2, 3 with 4, 1 with 4, 2 with 3, or 1 with 3 and 2 with 4. So that's the three possible parents or four elements. What are the contributions of them in our setting? So this is the phi of something where the first two variables have the same index and the next two have the same index. This here is phi of A1, A2, A2, A1, and this is phi of A1, A2, A1, A2. Okay. I mean, it doesn't matter whether I have one or two here, but they should just be the same at these positions and different for different blocks. Okay, what is the contribution of those? I mean, this one and this one calculates in exactly the same way as before, in a classical case. Because it's essentially something free, or this is free from this, so it just factorizes. So it's just phi of A times B, where A and B are free, which factorizes, so it factorizes, so I get just sigma to the 4. Here, this is something where I have in the middle something which is free from here. So this is the setting that I have, let's say, C1, B, C2, where the B is free from the C's. And also in this case, we have the same rule as in the classical setting. I mean, that's actually the rule which I used to single out singletons. So this was C1, C2, C of B. So this means the phi of this comes out. This gives a second moment, and then I'm left with phi of this, which gives another second moment. So it's again sigma to the 4. So that's the same contribution as for the classical one. But how about this one? Okay, this one, I mean, here we are really back to the definition of freeness. Namely, what I have here is a product, A1, A2, A1, A2, where neighbors are different, so it's an alternating product, but phi of each of them is 0. Okay, and according to the definition of freeness, this is 0. Okay, so that's really back to the definition of freeness, so this is 0. So we see that actually, I mean, we get different contributions for pi's, and I mean, we have those one here, which gives the same as in the classical case, but we have here another one, which gives 0. Okay, and it's true in general that we either get the same contribution as in the classical case, or we get 0. So this means it really depends somehow on the structure of our pairing, whether it contributes or not. And I mean, okay, as I have drawn these pictures, and I mean, probably I have mentioned non-crossing somewhere before, I mean, it's really the fact that I have a non-crossing pairing here or crossing one. So I mean, this picture things are crossing, so this is a crossing one which contributes. Okay, and what is the idea? I mean, when does it contribute? I mean, why does this contribute? I mean, this factorizes, but for example here, I have something in the middle, but I find two indices which are the same, which are neighbors, and then I can take them out by this rule of freeness. So whenever I find two indices as neighbors, I can just take them out. They appear as a second moment, and then I have to look on the rest. And if I can iterate this, always taking out neighbors, then in the end I get something which makes a contribution. If I'm not able to do this, then at some point I will have a pattern like this, which is so by the definition of freeness. Okay, so this means in general, if we are able to remove successively neighboring pairs of indices, then the kappa pi will be sigma to the n, as in the classical case. But otherwise, if you are not able to find those successively, then the contribution will be 0. Okay, and so maybe just an example. For example, if I have, let's say something. If I have a pairing like this, I mean, in this case, I can successively remove neighbors. I mean, here I have two indices which are the same, so I just take them out. Okay, they give me a second moment contribution. Here I have neighbors, another one, I take out this one, but now they have become neighbors, I can take them out, and then I'm left with the last one. So this gives a contribution which survives in the limit. Okay, but if I have, for example, something like this, I mean, then for a while it looks good. I mean, I'm finding neighbors, like for example here, I can take this out, I mean, I can also take out those two, but then, I mean, at some point I encounter this situation where it's not possible to find neighbors. I really get exactly this pattern that I have one block, then another block, the first block, and then the other block. So I really get this crossing pattern. Okay, and then and this part of the picture will give me zero. So this guy doesn't survive. Okay, and that's really, I mean, this one are the non-crossing ones. I mean, in this picture, if I'm really able to successfully remove these pairs, then this means I can draw it in such a way that I don't have crossings in the pictures. And if this is not the case, I mean, I will have something like this in my picture. Or maybe it could also be something more complicated, something like this. But this is also zero by freeness. Okay, so if I have this crossing patterns, then I will get zero. Okay, so this means what survives in the limit in this case are exactly the non-crossing pairings. Okay, so my central limit theorem in this case is k goes to infinity a1 up to ak divided by square root of k to the power of n. So this is sigma of n. And now, instead of counting all pairings, I mean, I just get contributions, always the same, from the non-crossing ones. So I have to count the number of non-crossing pairings. And those I'm denoting by nc2 of n. So these are the non-crossing pairings of n elements. Okay, so essentially, I mean, I have reduced the free central limit theorem to calculating those numbers. So it's a very similar problem as in the classical one. In the classical one, I just, the moments and limits were given by the numbers of pairings, but now they are given by the number of non-crossing pairings. Okay, it's a little bit more complicated to count them, but still it's an easy combinatorial problem, a very well-known problem, and actually what I get there are just the Catalan numbers. Okay, so namely, how do I count those guys? Okay, so let me denote the numbers here by Cn. So Cn, by definition, the number of elements, non-crossing pairings, of 2n elements. Of course, if n is odd, again, there's no pairing. So it should be an even number. Let's say 2n, and those numbers I call Cn. So how do I count them? So I have, again, n points, and now I count them again in the same way as before. I do it recursively. So first I look on the first block. Okay, so 1 is connected with something. Okay, and then I have to continue with the remaining blocks, but now the decisive difference to all partitions is, of course, I want it non-crossing. So this means the points which are between those two points here cannot be connected to points here. If I count all pairings, I mean, I don't bother about it. I just connect the remaining points. But here I have, really, I see that the remaining problem decomposes into this problem, and they don't have to do something, they don't interact. So I have to look for a non-crossing pairing here and a non-crossing pairing here. Okay, and of course I have to sum over those possibilities, but it is clear the number of points here must be even. Otherwise there are no non-crossing pairings. So if this is 1, and if I denote this by 2i, and the last point is 2n, then counting all non-crossing pairings of 2n points is the same as summing over the possibilities for this point. Let's say I is running from 1 up to n. So this point can be 2 up to 2n. Then count how many non-crossing pairings I have here, multiplying with the non-crossing pairings which I have here. But those guys I have denoted by c. So this here is ci minus 1 times cn minus 1. Okay, and that's actually the famous recursive relation for the Catalan numbers. Which n minus I. Yeah, okay. So they should sum up to n minus 1. I have taken away the first block. Good, okay, so this is the recursive relation for the Catalan numbers, which one can solve. I mean, there are explicit formulas for the Catalan numbers. When we see n is 1 over n plus 1, 2n over n. I mean, actually, this is not really important. I mean, really, to recognize the Catalan numbers, it's better to look for this recursive relation. Okay, of course you have to know C0 and C1 to get it somehow started. So C0 maybe by definition is 1, then C1 is 1, C2 is 2, C3 is 5, C4 is 14, and so on. So this one corresponds, we have one pairing of two elements. Here we have two non-crossing pairings, four elements. Well, there's a crossing one, a third one. We have five non-crossing pairings of six elements. Maybe those. Okay, and of course there are much more pairings. So there are 15 pairings, but the other ones are all crossing. Okay, only those five contribute. Good. Okay, and now, now of course, I mean, so we have now identified the moment in the limit of the central limit theorem, and I mean, actually, it's also quite easy to find a really a probability measure which has this guy at its moment. And this is the sinusoidal distribution, which was also addressed in the first lecture. But actually, I mean, I don't want to go into this in a moment. I mean, we might come back to this when we do those things a little bit more analytical. But it's really, I mean, usually one says the free central limit theorem, you are converting to a semicircular variable. But I mean, with a semicircular variable, we mean essentially one which has those numbers here as its moments. If you want to write down a distribution, I mean, you really can write down it's a semicircle density. Okay. Then maybe for the moment, I just define a semicircular variable by giving its distribution in terms of the moment. Okay, so definition. A random variable S with phi of s to the n is either so if n is odd, or sigma to the n times the corresponding Catalan number if n is even. Such a guy is called a semicircular variable or element, and of course sigma squared is the variance, so of variance sigma squared. Okay, so and then we can summarize our free central limit theorem, what we have proved, in the following. So if I have A1, A2, and so on, sitting in some probability space, if they are free and identically distributed, and their first moment was zero, and let me denote by sigma squared the second moment, then we have shown that A1 plus AK divided by square root of K converges in distribution, if K goes to infinity, to a semicircular variable S. So it goes to S, where S is a semicircular element of variance sigma squared. Okay, good. Then one should know that actually in the first lecture we have shown that such a semicircular variable S also appears in the limit of Gaussian random matrices. Also, if you read what we have done in the first lecture, you can also say that a Gaussian random matrices converge also to a semicircular element. And I mean, this was really the reason that Voiculescu looked more into the relation with random matrices. Okay, so I mean, in the beginning, freeness was really just defined on the operator algebraic side, and Voiculescu did a central limit theorem, not in these combinatorial terms, but in more analytical terms, but nevertheless, I mean, same kind of statement. So you convert to a semicircular variable, and I mean, the semicircular distribution, of course, there was very well known in random matrix theory. And this old theorem of Wigner tells you that you get a semicircle in a limit. So this was really the first hint that there might be a connection between random matrix theory and freeness. Okay, and I mean then, of course, Voiculescu found this out later, and this was somehow a very big step forward, because it really implied a lot of progress on free probability theory itself and also applications to random matrices. Good. Okay, but so I mean, there are also multivariate versions of this. Okay, I'm not going to talk about it now. Maybe we put it down in the manuscript, which we are going to put up. I want now to go over to more systematic theory of cumulants. And I mean, this year we are essentially taking as a motivation that in free probability theory, non-crossing pairings, or maybe more generally, non-crossing partitions should play a similar role as all pairings or all partitions in the classical theory. And I mean, in the first lecture, it was somehow pointed out that we have classical cumulants, which are very important in a classical context, and they essentially go with all pairings. Okay, and we are going to introduce now non-crossing cumulants, which go with non-crossing pairings or partitions, and which will be a very powerful tool for really understanding the structure of the mixed moments. Okay, but so maybe we take a break now of 10 minutes and then I continue. Okay, so let's continue. So now I want to talk about the more general theory of free cumulants. And I mean, those free cumulants should be connected with non-crossing partitions. So let me first define you what I mean in general with non-crossing partitions. So this will be about non-crossing partitions and free cumulants. So, I mean, I have used before notion of partition and so on. Maybe let us make it more formal at the moment. So partition of a set. Okay, and the set in our case usually will just be the numbers 1 up to n for various n. So this is nothing else than a decomposition into disjoint non-empty subsets. So this is a decomposition pi of v1 up to vs or vr. Say we are such that the VIs are not empty. They should be disjoint, and of course their union should be S. Okay, so it's just a decomposition of our set S. Okay, the VIs are called blocks. So VI are blocks of pi, and as before, I used this before, so Pn is the set of all partitions of this set 1 up to n. Good. Okay, but now as we have seen, in free probability, it's not all partitions which play a role, but it's only the special ones, which are non-crossing, and so when is a pi non-crossing? Yeah, if it's non-crossing, if successively I can remove intervals, or maybe if it not happens that I have a crossing between blocks. So non-crossing really refers to the fact that if I'm drawing a picture of my partition, then the blocks shouldn't have, I should be able to draw it in such a way that the blocks don't have crossings. Okay, and so this means we should not have the following situation. We should not have the situation, okay, that I have my numbers here, then I have P1, Q1, P2, Q2, and I mean for this non-crossingness, of course it's important that my set is ordered. I need an order. Just for partition I don't need an order, but I mean to talk about crossing or non-crossing I need an order. Okay, so it should happen that, okay, if I have ordered my numbers here, such that I'm not having the situation that P1 and P2 are in the same block. There might be other elements in the block. And that Q1 and Q2 are in the same block, but the P's and the Q's are not in the same block. So it should not happen that I have two different blocks for which I have elements which are lying in this way. Because this, if we do not have this situation. Good. Okay, because if I have this, then I have a crossing between the blocks. Good. Okay, so if I don't have this, then I call it non-crossing, and I denote the non-crossing partitions of n elements by nc of n. So nc of n is the set of pi pn such that pi is non-crossing. Okay, and I mean, yeah. One should make this remark that actually this non-crossing is the same as being able to remove successively intervals of neighbors. Because that's usually the way how you really, in a recursive way, deal with non-crossing permutations, partitions. So maybe let us make this as a remark. So being non-crossing really means one can successively remove blocks which consist of intervals, which means all the elements in these blocks are just neighbors. For example, maybe something like this. Let's make it bigger. Okay. So I mean, here I have an interval, so I can remove this one, here I have an integral, I can remove this one, I can remove this and this, and then this gets an integral, I can remove this one, and after I have removed everything on the inside, also this one here is an integral. Oh, okay, so successively I can remove those guys, and this is really the same as this definition. Okay, then, these non-crossing partitions are not just a set, but they also have some structure. So namely, in particular, there's a partial order on this set, so I can compare some of my partitions. In this partial order, I mean, I have it also on all partitions, so we have a partial order on P of n and C of n. So it will not be really important in the following, but I mean, it's for more advanced arguments, it's really important. So I can say that P is less than sigma if each block of pi is contained in some block of pi, in some block of sigma, in a block of sigma. So each block of pi should be contained in some block of sigma. So this means I'm getting the blocks of pi by splitting some of the blocks of sigma into subblocks. Okay, but of course it's clear I cannot compare any two partitions. I mean, there are partitions which are uncomparable. Okay, but at least, I mean, some of them can be compared, so I have a partial order. Okay, so this means n C of n becomes a partially ordered set, or what is called a poset. And actually, there's more structure. So namely, if I have two elements, I always have a minimum and a maximum, so actually, I mean, nc of n becomes a lattice. Okay. So actually, p of n and also nc of n are lattices. So this means for any two pi and sigma, I have a unique one which is bigger than both of them, smallest one which is bigger than, and I have a unique one, maximal one, which is smaller of them. So I have a minimum and a maximum of two elements. That's usually what defines a lattice. Okay, I mean, this is not really important in the following, but I mean, it's good to know that I really have quite a lot of structure around. Good. Okay, but so that's just the basic information about non-crossing partitions, and now we are going to use them for defining our free cumulants. That's the crucial object in our approach to free probability theory, to understand at this moment. So, what are those guys? So we assume we have a non-commutative probability space, and then I want to define what I call free cumulants, the corresponding, and of course they are defined in terms of phi, they depend on the given phi. So the free cumulants, so this will be kappa n for each n, one of them. Okay. And kappa n, what is kappa n? This is a functional on A which has n arguments. So kappa n has n arguments, so it's a n-linear functional. And I want to define all of them, and they are defined in a sense indirectly by writing down a formula which tells me how moments and cumulants are related. Okay, but I mean, I really give it in a way that I say the moments are given in terms of the cumulants, so actually you have to invert this relation, but it's easier to write it down on in this way. So I define by a formula which usually we are calling the moment cumulant formula, so by the following, because it relates the moments and the cumulants, by the following formulas, so it says phi of a1 an, so we have a product, so this is given by summing over pi in nc of n, so I'm summing over all non-crossing partitions, and I get a contribution which I denote by kappa pi of my arguments, and I have to say what I mean is this. This formula is for all natural numbers and for all a1 up to an in my algebra. Oh, okay, so I mean this is motivated on one hand by the fact that you have analog formulas in classical probability theory. Maybe they came up a little bit in the first lecture, but there you sum over all partitions And then, I mean, we also have seen in the free central limit theorem that actually the moments which you get in the limit are given by summing over, okay, it's only parents here, and then you also had things which are called kappa pi, which were somehow the contributions coming from the pairings. Okay, so the kappas which I had there were actually the cumulants of the semicirculars. Good. Okay, but I mean, of course, I should say what I mean is this kappa pi here, kappa indexed by a pi, and this is actually a product of kappas corresponding to the blocks of my pi. So I will make it a bit clearer with examples, maybe. But this kappa pi is a product of kappas according to the block structure of pi. Namely, essentially, the blocks of pi tell me which arguments I should put into the kappas. So the kappas need some arguments, and I will distribute these arguments into the various kappas, which I take here, and I have to distribute the argument in a way which is given by the blocks. So each block corresponds to one kappa, and those arguments should appear in this kappa. Okay, but probably the best is to do this by example, to make clear what this means. And also, I mean, to see that this really defines the kappas. I mean, this is really phi given in terms of complicated expression in terms of the kappa, then I say this is a definition for the kappas. So I mean, this is not an explicit formula, but I mean, one should see that one is able to solve this for the kappas. Okay, let us first look on the simplest case, n equal to 1. So there it says phi of A1 is given by what? I should sum over non-crossing pairs of one element. So we're thinking of our element is A1, and there's only one pairing, eh? So there's only one term. Okay, and this term is just the kappa 1 of the A1. The A1 goes there as an argument. Okay, so this of course tells me that kappa 1 is. Okay. So this means, of course, so kappa 1, the first one, is nothing else than my state phi. Okay, but so what was the second one? So the second formula tells me that phi of A1 and A2 is given. Now I should sum over the pairings, the partitions, of two elements. So there are two of them, this and this. Okay. And I mean, I get two contributions. This gives me a contribution where the A1 and the A2 go together as arguments in one kappa. So this is a kappa which has two arguments. So it's A1 comma A2. And then I get contribution corresponding to this. So here I have a product of two kappas. So the first kappa takes just the A1 as an argument. The second one takes the A2. Plus kappa 1 of A1 times kappa 1 of A2. Okay, so that's the meaning of this formula for n equal to 2, and now you see that actually, after knowing what kappa 1 is, I can use this formula for writing down what kappa 2 is, because, I mean, I already know kappa 1 in terms of phi. So this tells me that kappa 2 of A1 comma A2 is nothing than phi of A1 A2 minus, and this is just phi of A1 times phi of A2. So actually kappa 2 is the covariance of my two elements. And then for n equal to 3, so I have A1, A2, A3, I have to sum over the non-crossing partitions. I mean, still we don't see a difference between non-crossing and not. It's only this n equal to 4, you see that, but nevertheless, I mean, the structure of the formula should be clear. So we have 5 of them, namely those 5 partitions, and each of them gives a contribution to the first one. So what we are looking here at is phi of A1, A2, A3. So this is given, the first one, is where all the arguments go together in one kappa, so it's kappa 3 of A1, A2, A3. Then the next one, A1 and A2 go together in one kappa, multiplied with a kappa which has the A3 as an argument. So it's plus kappa 2 of A1, comma A2 times kappa 1 of A3. Then the next one is kappa 2 of kappa 1 of A1 times kappa 2 of A2, A3. Then this one puts A1 and A3 together. So it's kappa 2 of A1 comma A3 and multiplies it with kappa 1 of A2. And the last one, okay, it has three kappas, and each of them has just a single A as an argument. So it's kappa 1 of A1, kappa 1 of A2 times kappa 1 of A3. Oh, okay, so and that's the structure in general, but of course you're only summing over the non-crossing ones. In a classical context, you would sum over all partitions. I mean, up to this point, it would be exactly the same. because I mean all, there are no more. There's no crossing partitions of three elements, only with four and higher number of points you see a crossing feature. Okay, but again, I mean, you see, we have exactly one highest term, a term which we haven't defined up to this point. I mean, we know up to this point, we know kappa 1 and kappa 2, and in this formula, there's only one term which contains kappa 3, which exactly corresponds to this contribution which only has one block. The other ones have more blocks, and of course the blocks have to be smaller than 3. They must be 1 and 2, so it only involves kappa 1 and kappa 2, and we know all those guys. We know kappa 1 and we know kappa 2, so this means we can resolve this for kappa 3. Okay. Maybe write it down so that we get, in this case, is kappa 3 of A1, A2, A3. So it's phi of A1, A2, A3. Okay, and then we get other terms. And we get minus signs, minus phi of A1, phi of A2, A3, minus phi of A2, phi of A1, A3, minus phi of A3, phi of A1, A2, and plus 2 times phi of A1, phi of A2, phi of A3. Okay, so what we see here, essentially we get somehow the same kind of patterns with partitioning the A's, but we get different coefficients here. We get minus signs and we get numbers here. Okay, so in principle, you can write down, you can resolve this and say the kappa is given by some function in terms of the phi, and you can also say something about the coefficients. I mean, in abstract setting, this is a Möbius inversion of the formula which we had before. I mean, we really have a poset here, so we really have a Möbius inversion. Okay, but it's much simpler to write down this formula because here all the coefficients are 1. If you invert it, you get the Möbius function there. And okay, it's not, you can't write it down as explicitly as you can do it for all partitions. So for all partitions, it's somehow quite easy to write it the other way. You get binomial coefficients and you really can write it down. In this setting, one would have to talk too much about it. So it's usually much better to start from this relation and just to observe that really, in principle, you can invert it. And you can somehow understand it, but you have to work a little bit. Okay, so by Möbius inversion, you can really understand the structure which you have here. But you should see, I mean, it's a summation essentially over non-crossing partitions. You get the same partition in here, but you get some coefficients, which are essentially the Möbius function in this poset. Good. Okay, so that's the definition. Of course, I mean, one can make many definitions, so the question is, what is it good for? Is it really something which helps us to understand mixed stimulants and all those guys? And for this, one should think about the properties, and I mean there are some basic properties of these cumulants which I want to address now, and of course maybe the most important of them is that it gives a nice description of freeness, a description which is much better than the definition in terms of moments. Okay, so let me talk about properties of the cumulants. Okay, the first one, I mean, this is quite simple, and we're actually just pointing out that kappa m is really an n-linear object in its n variables. I mean, this follows more or less from the structure of this formula. As you see it here, if you invert this, it's linear in all of these arguments. So it's linear. So the linear structure of the kappa is quite easy to understand. It's just a linear object. Then, of course, the question is, how does it behave with respect to multiplication? Multiplication on the level of the phi is very simple. I mean, it's just putting brackets, so there's nothing much to say. But, of course, this goes over to something which is not so easy to understand on the level of the cumulants, but nevertheless, there's a nice combinatorial formula. So I don't want to talk too much about it, but I just want to point out that actually there exists a combinatorial formula which allows us to deal with cumulants where the arguments are actually products of random variables Okay, now maybe I just want to give an example to give you somehow the flavor of this kind of formula. So namely, for example, if I have, let's say, kappa 2, that the first argument is actually a product of two random variables. Huh? So this is the first argument. So kappa 2 has two arguments. The first one is A1, A2, and the second one is A3. Okay, so I'm building up the arguments from some things, let's say, which I know. So what I know are somehow the cumulants where the A1, A2, and A3 are just there as single arguments. And the question is there some kind of relation between this cumulant and the cumulants where the AIs appear separately? And actually, I mean, there is a formula. Namely, I can express it as a kappa pi's of A1, A2, A3. So these are, again, products of kappas, where just the A's go as arguments, according to pi. And the question, of course, is over which pi do I sum here? So it's very similar to what I do in the definition, but there I sum over all pi. But now I only sum over those which somehow correspond to the product which I have here. Namely, what I should sum over are those partitions which somehow connect all the arguments which I have here. So namely, this one, and this one. So I have here two blocks of arguments, and I look for partitions of these arguments, but which have the property that those two blocks should be connected. I mean, there are two more. Namely, there is this one and this one, but with this partition, I mean, this block is not connected to this one. So I mean, this one is not good, and this one is also not good. So what I'm summing about here are those three guys. So this means in this case, okay, so I'm summing over those pi, which have this property. So in this case, it would be the first one, which is kappa 3, A1, A2, A3. The second one, so this is kappa 2 of A1, A3, times kappa 1 of A2, plus this third one, I did the other way around, okay. So this is this one, kappa 2 of A2, A3, kappa 1 times A1. Okay, so I have a formula which tells me how to express cumulants, the sum of the arguments are products, in terms of the cumulants where I don't have products. And I mean, it's really, that's a general structure. It should be partitions which connect the blocks which I have here, which I can write down in terms of lattice operations on my set. Good. Okay, so I mean, this is a nice formula. It's useful, and I need it at some point for doing proofs or dealing with my cumulants, so it's really important to have it. But let me now concentrate maybe on the most important feature of the free cumulants. Why is it a good definition in the context of free probability theory? And it's a good condition because it allows me to decide quite easily when random variables are free. Namely, on the level of cumulants, freeness is the same as the vanishing of mixed cumulants. That's the most important property of the free cumulants, the property which is the motivating property for defining it. So namely, freeness is equivalent to the vanishing of mixed cumulants. Okay, and let me write this down more concretely. What I mean with this, so this is the following theorem. So namely, I have a non-commutative probability space. Kappa n are the corresponding cumulants, which are defined, as we just explained, the corresponding free cumulants. And then the statement is, if I have subalgebras A1 up to As in A, the question is, are they free or not? And this is, in terms of cumulants, somehow easier to decide than in terms of the definition, namely if they are free, if and only if we have the following, namely, whenever n is bigger than 2, and whenever I take elements from some of the subalgebras, and I'm looking on the cumulant of A1, A2 up to An, then this is zero whenever it happens that there exist two A's which are coming from different subalgebras. So you recall, it looks similar as definition in terms of moments. For moments, we took alternating A's, so neighbors have to come from different algebras, and in addition, we had to require that each of them should be centered. Okay, but now, we don't need centeredness here, and we don't really need that neighbors are from different algebras. It only has to be the case that at least two different A's two different subalgebras are here. So whenever I have K and L, such that the K subalgebra is another one than the L's one. Okay. So let me remark on the proof and also on the structure of this formula. I mean, of course, it looks similar as for the moment, but I mean we have somehow weaker conditions. So if I would consider the same situation as for the moment, so if I would consider that the A's should be alternatingly come from different subalgebras and that they are centered, I mean then it's somehow quite clear that I should get this condition. Because I mean then I would just transfer things from the moment to the cumulant. Also, I have always this relation between moments and cumulants. So moments and cumulants are essentially, the cumulants are the same as the corresponding moment up to some lower order correction terms. So if I have a condition on the level of the moments, usually this relation allows me to prove the corresponding statement for the cumulants. Okay, but the point here is that the statement becomes better for the cumulants. Namely, the lower order corrections are chosen in such a way that they really improve on my statement. So I don't really need the centeredness, and I don't need that neighbors have to be different. And I mean, it was really the centeredness which make this calculation of mixed moments very hard, because you always have to center your things, and so this is really the reason that it's very hard to understand the structure of your formula. Okay, so it's really, I mean, if I would have here the same conditions as for moments, then I mean the theorem would be quite trivial. Then it would just be by induction on this. Okay, but I mean you have to work harder, because you have to see that you have weaker conditions here. So the two points for the proof is, so here remark on proof. Okay, so if we assume the same conditions on the AI as in the definition of freeness, okay, then the statement is quite easy. Follows easily by the moment cumulant formula. Because more or less moments and cumulants are the same up to lower order corrections, and I mean these lower order corrections usually don't interfere much with the statement. Okay, but the point is that actually they are chosen in such a way that they allow things become much better. So what one has to show is that one can be better. So namely, one has to show that centeredness is not important, so one can forget about centeredness. I don't need that the A's are centered. And secondly, I weaken the assumption alternating to mixed. Okay, and to prove two, I mean, the best way to do is really to involve this formula for the products. And one essentially relies on the fact that the unit plays a very special role, namely that if I have a cumulant where I have one entry one, then this is actually zero. So maybe I want to at least write this down, maybe prove it. Okay, so one depends on the following. So namely the following proposition, that whenever I have n bigger than 2, and I have n random variables, then kappa n of a1 up to an is 0 whenever one of the random variables is 1. Okay. I mean, I should see that this is actually a special case of this theorem, because we know that 1 is free from everything. So if this theorem tells us in particular that if I have a 1 appearing in a random variable, because it's free from all the other variables which appear there, the cumulant should be 0. Okay, but actually, I mean, proving this special case is really an important step in the proof of this general theorem, because this is really the step which allows me to get rid of the centeredness, because this tells me that in the cumulants I can center my variables without changing its value. I mean, if I do this for the moments, of course I am changing them very much, and that's really the problem with calculating mixed moments. But if I center variables under the cumulants, then this here tells me, of course, the first cumulant changes. But the first cumulant, I mean, then it's just a shift. But all the other ones don't change. So really, I have redefined the moment in such a way with these lower order terms that actually this shift doesn't show up on the higher ones. So I mean, then the consequence of this is that if I have cumulants, arbitrary, A1 up to AN, of arbitrary random variables, then I can shift, I can center each of them without changing its value. Because if I just, I mean, it's multilinear, so if I multiply it out, I get a term where I have A1 up to AN, and then I get a lot of other terms, but each of the other terms has at least one as an argument. Okay, and this is zero. So centering doesn't show up. Okay, and the proof, I mean, okay, let me show you the proof of this statement, because it's somehow half of the, maybe the easy half of the proof of this theorem, which shows me how to get rid of the centeredness. And to make it easier, let us assume that I put the 1 as the last argument. Then at least I can write down things concretely. I mean, the 1 could be anywhere, any of the arguments, but let's say it's the last one. Okay, so I want to show that kappa n of A1, comma AN minus 1, arbitrary A1 up to A1 n minus 1, and the last one is 1, that this is equal to 0. Okay, and I mean, I'm going to show it by induction. So I assume that I know already this statement, if this is less than n, and now I want to show it for n. Okay, for this I'm looking on my moment cumulant formula, because that's the one which tells me what my cumulants are. Okay, and I'm looking on this product, A1 up to AN minus 1 times 1, so this has n arguments, so I'm using the formula for n, so I'm summing over cumulants, and let me write down the highest order term, so this is kappa n of A1 up to AN minus 1, comma 1, and then I have all the other terms, so I'm summing over non-Gaussian partitions of n elements, and I am not summing over this anymore, I have already done this explicitly, so I'm excluding this one. So here I'm only summing over the partitions which have more than two blocks or more. Okay, and here I have kappa pi of A1 up to AN minus 1, comma 1. Okay, good. So but what are these kappa pi's? These are products of cumulants according to the blocks of pi. And I mean all the blocks which I consider here are less than n. So for those I know by assumption that if those blocks couple a 1 with anything else, then it has to be 0. Okay, so the only possibility that I get something is where the pi is stays for itself. Because then I get a kappa 1 of 1. Of course, kappa 1 of 1, this is phi of 1, this is 1. Okay, so all the higher cumulants having a 1 as an argument vanish, but if I have a kappa 1, then it's okay. Okay, so the only possibility for pi is contributing here are those where the 1 is a singleton. Okay, so this means the 1 here, this argument stays for itself, and then I mean I can do whatever I want with the other ones. So the pi's which contribute here are actually of the form, it's sigma, and then I have this block 1. And the sigma must of course be a non-crossing partition of n minus 1 elements. It just puts this together. Okay, but then the kappa pi of this pi, of course, decomposes into the factors coming from here, but this is just the kappa sigma times the kappa 1 of this guy, which is just 1. So the kappa pi of the argument A1 up to AN minus 1, comma 1, is the same as the kappa sigma of A1 up to AN minus 1 times kappa 1 of 1, and this is 1. Okay, so you see, what we get is actually we are summing over kappa sigma of A1 up to AN minus 1, and we are summing over all possibilities for non-crossing partitions of N minus 1 elements. But again, by the moment cumulant formula, this is just the same as phi of this product. This is just the moment cumulant formula for N minus 1. So what I get here is this first term, which actually I want to determine, an minus 1, comma 1. Okay, but then these lower order terms actually are the same as summing over kappa sigma of this guy, which is nothing else than phi of a1 times to an minus 1. Well, just the 1 is missing. But on the level of the phi, it doesn't matter whether I have the 1 here or not. So actually, I mean, this here is the same as this guy, which tells me, of course, that this guy must be equal to 0. Well, because, I mean, on the level of the phi, the effect of the 1 doesn't matter. I mean, 1 just disappears. Okay. And, I mean, this shows that this, if I rewrite it on the level of the cumulants, this means if I have it as an argument, it will be equal to 0. Okay, so this tells me kappa n of a1 up to an minus 1, comma 1 has to be equal to 0. Okay, so this, yeah, so this shows somehow that the free cumulants have a very nice property if one of the arguments is 1, and this has the effect that centering on the level of the cumulants is very easy to deal with, in contrast on the level of the moments. Good. Okay, and then, I mean, one also has to see what happens if I multiply neighboring elements together and such things, but this can be dealt with this combinatorial formula. Hmm? Okay, so and this results in this theorem, which tells me that on the level of the cumulants, freeness is the same of the vanishing of the mixed moments. Okay, and this now somehow allows to deal with the problem of the sum of free random variables. It shows that the cumulants are really the right object for dealing with this. And this was the R transform and the free convolution of Vaculescu, but which in this combinatorial framework comes very natural. So now let us mainly look essentially on one random variable. Specialize deformation which we have to one random variable. So consider case of one random variable, let's say A. Okay, then, I mean, what is the information which we have about such a random variable? Distribution, and of course in terms of moments, this means it's just phi applied to powers of A. Huh? So the information which we usually consider are all moments, phi of A to the n. Okay, maybe the following I will denote then by alpha n. Okay, but of course now, in this cumulant philosophy, we should go over to cumulants. So instead of all moments, it should probably be better to consider also all cumulants, and those are the cumulants where all entries of my kappa n are just A. I mean, I'm using free cumulants in two different ways. I mean, the kappa n's are just linear functionals, n-linear functionals, which are defined in the whole algebra. So they are very, very big objects. But on the other hand, if I'm just looking at one random variable, I'm just interested in the cumulants where each of the entries is A. And then it's just a sequence of numbers. In the same way as the moments are just a sequence of numbers. So I also have the free cumulants of my random variables, which are those kappa n's. Okay, and I mean, okay, I don't need all those arguments, so maybe I just denote this by kappa n and put the index A here to denote that it's the free cumulants of A. Okay, and now one of the basic problems in free probability theory is the question, what happens if I sum two free random variables? That's the same question as in a classical context, what happens if I sum two independent random variables? And of course the answer is given by the free convolution. So we are actually asking, how can we deal with the free convolution in this context? So, and the cumulants behave very nicely with respect to adding things. So namely, if A and B are free, then what happens to the cumulants of A plus B? Okay, by definition, the cumulants of A plus B are the nth cumulant functional where I put each entry as A plus B. Okay, now by multilinearity, of course, I multiply this out. So this gives me kappa n, where all entries are A, then kappa n, where all entries are B, and then I get a lot of terms where some of the entries are A and some of the entries are B. That's because A and B are free, and we just have seen that mixed cumulants of free guys vanish, all those other terms are zero. So this means that the only contribution, and I mean, so these are just kappa n of A, and these are the kappa n of B. Okay, so, I mean, on the level of the moments, the moments of the sum of free variables is not easy to understand. I mean, we know in principle there's a formula, but I mean, okay, it's not so clear what the structure of this formula is. But on the level of the cumulants, this shows us, the vanishing of the mixed cumulants shows us that the cumulants are just additive. All the cumulants are just add up. Okay, so this means on the level of the cumulants, it's very easy to deal with the free convolution. Of course, I mean, the problem is somehow shifted to understanding the relation between moments and cumulants. Because, I mean, moments are things which you, okay, if you are given random variables, you say, okay, I know what are the moments. If you want to go over to the level of the cumulants, you should know how to get the cumulants out of the moments and how to go back. And of course, I mean, our definition is in principle a definition which tells this to us, but it's in combinatorial terms, which means it might not be easy to do it in practice. Okay, but now I want to show you that actually, I mean, that you can rewrite this relation in terms of generating power series, which is a very nice and compact form, and which opens the road to a real analytic approach to this. Okay, so what still has to be done is maybe to understand the relation between moments and cumulants better in a more compact way. Okay, so at the moment, I mean, the cumulants are defined by this moment-cumulant formula. So we have somehow a nice combinatorial structure which tells us that the alpha n are given by summing over pi in nc of n of kappa pi. So maybe just to write it down again, so alpha 1 is the same as kappa 1, alpha 2 is the same, I mean, we have to sum over the non-crossing ones, and then we get the kappas, and in this, I mean, we don't have to bother about the arguments, so we just take the kappas, and the index is just the length of the block. So we have here kappa 2 plus kappa 1 times kappa 1, alpha 3 is kappa 3 plus 3 times kappa 1, kappa 2, plus kappa 1 to the power 3. So this is this non-crossing partition. Then we have three non-crossing partitions where we have a block of size 1 and a block of size 2. Each of them will give a contribution kappa 1 times kappa 2. Because the arguments are all the same, so you don't have to distinguish them. And then we have one non-crossing partition where we have three blocks each of size 1. Okay, so I mean in principle, this here is a formula like this, but it's not really clear how we can use this for concrete calculations. So what I want to show is that I can translate this into formal power series, which is much more accessible to concrete calculations. Okay, and I mean this is a general tool in algebraic combinatorics. I mean, if you have a combinatorial relation between two sequences of numbers, then at least you can hope that this combinatorial relation has some nice reinterpretation between the power series. So let us consider here the formal power series. So formal means I'm really just considered as formal, not bothering about convergence. We will come to analytic aspects in the next lecture. Okay, so m of z is the one of the moments. So I take alpha n, z to the n, so this is the moment series, and c of z is 1 plus kappa n, z to the n. This is the cumulant series. Of course, I was given a random variable a, so I'm not going to put a there. Okay, now is the question, can I express this relation as a relation between this power series in a nice way? Okay, and the question is, what does this mean? And I mean, instead of going directly to the power series, I try to rewrite this in a recursive way. I mean, you remember, I mean, I did a few calculations of counting non-crossing things, and you always, it's good to do it in a recursive way. You start with the first block, and then you see what remains. Yeah, I mean, we could say this is alpha 0, which is phi of 1, which would fit. Okay, but I mean, having here 1, I mean, kappa 0 is, we don't really have defined kappa 0, so it's... Okay, so I mean, I'm starting n equal to 1. I just want to write down explicitly that I have here the constant terms. Because, I mean, sometimes if I'm dealing with power series, maybe sometimes I want the constant term, sometimes I don't want it, so I want to write it down explicitly. Yeah, so what does it mean? I mean, we have n points, and we have to sum over all non-crossing partitions. And again, I'm looking on the first block. And the first block, so this means the block containing 1. So this will contain some other elements. It might... So I have some points here. Maybe let's say this is V1, this is V2. Oh no, let's say this is V1, so this is V2, this is V3, and this is Vs. So this plot has length S. And then of course I have might have other points in between. The last point is N. Okay, now I essentially can encode this information about such a partition by saying, okay, I mean I have this guys here, but maybe it's better to encode this by saying how many points I have in between. So let me call this I1, here I have I2, and so on. And here I also have some points left, I have many. And then, of course, what I have here in between is some other non-crossing partition. Of course, non-crossing means all these points must be connected to themselves, those points must be connected to themselves. So I have here some other in between, I have some other non-crossing partition. Maybe let me call it I1 of I1 twiddle, here I have pi 2 twiddle, of so many points of I1 points, and so on. And here I have pi s twiddle. Yeah. Okay, so now let me see. So if I now, alpha n is given by summing over all non-crossing partitions, but now I encode those non-crossing partitions by saying what is the structure of the first block, and then by having the remaining part. And So I have to sum over all possible lengths of the first block, let me call this S, and then I have to sum over all possible numbers of points which I might have in between. They might start from 0, might go up to something, and of course, I mean, the sum of all points must be N. So I have here I1 up to IS, bigger than 0, and the number of all points, so this is I1 plus up to IS, and then of course the points from this first block, which is S, these together should be N. Okay, and then of course I have to sum over all the pi's which I have in between here. So I'm summing over pi 1 twiddle in nc of I1 up to pi s twiddle in nc of is. Okay, and then I get here the contribution. What do I get? I get the kappa pi. Okay, so kappa pi is the product of kappas for the block. So the first block of course, this will be a kappa s. The length of this block is s, so this is a kappa s. Okay, then I will get a product of kappas corresponding to the blocks of this guy here, but this is of course the same what we would call kappa of pi 1 twiddle. So we get here kappa of pi 1 twiddle, so this is the product of the kappas corresponding to the blocks of kappa pi 1 twiddle, and so on, kappa of pi s twiddle. Okay. Good, but now we are seeing we are summing. Now I'm summing over pi 1 twiddle. Pi 1 twiddle only appears here, but summing over the cumulants of kappa pi 1 twiddle, where pi 1 twiddle is running over all non-crossing partitions of I1 points, exactly gives me the corresponding moment of I1 points. That's again the moment cumulant formula. I mean, the point is always the big problem is decomposed into the first block times the same kind of problem between the blocks. But the same kind of problem for smaller number of points. So summing over this gives me the moment of I1, and so on. Summing over this gives me the moment of IS. So this means what I get here is actually a recursion between the alphas and the kappas, namely alpha n, is still summing over the possibilities for the first block, so S from 1 to n, and the sum over these I's, I1 up to IS, such that the sum of I1 plus IS plus S is equal to N. And then I have here the kappa S. Okay, but the sum over this gives me the alpha I1, the I1's moment. Sum over this gives me the IS moment. Okay, now you see I have a recursion. It's not that I'm expressing the alphas totally in terms of the kappas, but I have to do some partial summation, so I have a recursion. Of course, here only smaller I's appear. Okay, and this is now very close to rewriting it in a form of power series, namely now I can multiply here with the power set to the n. Okay, and I mean the sets I can distribute in a very nice way. I mean I give S to this guy, I give I1 to this guy, I give IS to this one, and it fits because I have this constraint that the sum of the I's plus the S is exactly n. Okay, but then you see what I'm doing here, and then okay, I'm summing also over the n here, so that I get here the power series for the moment, and what I have here on this side is now an easy operation on the level of power series. So namely, what I get here is, I mean, I should take out the constant 1, I mean, I should think about separately what this really does, but then I'm left with summing over the s. Here I have the kappa s, set to the S. But then, I mean, summing over the I's here really gives me just the power series for the alphas. So, I mean, I'm summing here once over it, so I'm getting the sum over alpha I to the set to the I, summing from 0 to infinity, and I have this to the power S.
Huh?
This is a formal power series. Jamie will talk about analytic problems next week. You can ask him. Okay, good. So what we get here, summing over I1 just gives me this power series once, then I multiply it by summing over I2 and so on. So I get an S-fold product of this power series, and then you'll see, summing again, what I'm doing here is I'm getting the power series of the kappas, but Z times this guy is the argument. Huh? Okay, so this means what I really have here is that M of Z, this side, is the same as this power series, and on this side I have the power series for the cumulants, but the argument is Z times this power series. But this power series is just M of Z again. So I have here, this is C, and the argument is Z times M of Z. Okay, so you see, I mean, it's just a very simple reformulation of this combinatorial relation between moments and cumulants into generating power series. And maybe just a final remark that usually, I mean, you prefer to deal not with the generating power series, but with the Cauchy transform, which is very close. And I mean, then this, of course, can be rewritten into this form, and this is the famous R transform formula of Voiculescu, which I just want to write down as the last statement. Okay, so I mean, instead of the moment series, I consider the Cauchy transform, which, let's say, is defined as this guy, phi of the level event. But if you take this, if you do the form of power series expansion, this is actually more or less the moment series, by not in set, but in 1 over set. And you get also n shift by 1. Huh? So if you just extend the geometric series, this is the same as this. And this is what I call here m, but it's 1 over set times m in 1 over set. Essentially, it's replacing set by 1 over set. Okay, so that's the Cauchy transform, and this is something which has nice analytic properties. Okay, so Jamie will talk about this next week. So usually one prefers to deal with things in terms of the Cauchy transform. And so, instead of the C transform, Voiculescu defined something which he called the R transform, which also has a little shift. So namely, the R transform, defined by Voiculescu, is not the C which we have there, so it's C of Z minus 1 divided by Z. So in terms of the cumulants, it's a power series, where I have a shift of 1 in the coefficients. Okay, so that's the R transform, which was defined by Voiculescu. Okay, and then if you rewrite, so M is more or less the same as G, and C is more or less the same as R, so of course you can rewrite this equation in terms of G and R, and what it means, what you get in the end, is that this relation in terms of G and R reads as that if you take G, and as an argument you take R of Z, plus 1 over Z, this is equal to Z. Also, this means R plus 1 over Z is the inverse under composition of G. Of course, it's also the other way around. So you can also say that that R of G of Z plus 1 over G of Z is equal to Z. That's the same equation saying this is the inverse of this, is the same as saying that this is the inverse of this. Okay, and this is the formula for Voiculescu for the R transform. So I mean, you can more or less use it for defining the R transform without doing all this combinatorial interpretation, and then somehow you can prove that the coefficients of the R transform are additive. You see, the coefficients are the cumulants, and we know that they are additive. So of course we also know that the R transform of A plus B, if A and B are free, is the same as the R transform of A plus the R transform of B. Okay, so essentially, I mean, Voiculescu defined the R transform somehow by this relation, or realizing things somehow on a Fock space, and seeing that you have these two kind of relations. Okay, but I mean, you see this combinatorial approach, you can also prove these things very easily. And I mean, this is just a reformulation of this combinatorial relation between moments and cumulants, and this is the fact that mixed cumulants vanish, or an easy consequence of this fact. Good. Okay, so I think I should stop here. And next time, I mean, so Jimmy, we talk next time more about the analytic properties of those formulas. I mean, what I'm talking here about was, of course, the situation where you have all moments, and so maybe it's about compactly supported measures, but if you have formulas like this, and you are really able to deal with them as analytic functions, not just as formal power series, then you can, I mean, the Cauchy transform you can define for every probability measure. So you can use this for to defining the R transform for every probability measure, and then you can deal with the free convolution. Okay, but so I mean, you need to look more into the analytic structure of the formulas and the involved functions. Okay, but this will be the content of next week. So, thank you.